A ribbon of white stars flies toward a snowy mountain and forms an arching halo over its peak. A logo appears. Paramount, a Paramount Communications company. Now, our view trails down a black computer screen covered with numbered codes. Titles appear in white letters. Paramount Pictures presents a Mace Neufeld and Robert Ramey production. In flickering red letters, a title reads, Patriot Games. Starring Harrison Ford, Ann Archer, Patrick Bergen, Sean Bean, Thora Birch, James Fox, Samuel L. Jackson, Polly Walker, and J.E. Freeman, with James Earl Jones and Richard Harris as Paddy O'Neill. Now the red letters grow larger and larger, filling our view. We race over a dense forest of treetops, their spidery limbs naked of leaves. The whole landscape is tinted red. The trees fade from glowing red to a more natural brown. More titles appear. Casting by Amanda Mackey, CSA, and Kathy Sandrich, CSA. Music composed by James Horner. Costume designer, Norma Morisot. Edited by Neil Travis, ACE, and William Hoy. Production designer, Joseph Nemec III. Director of Photography, Donald M. McAlpine, ASC. Executive producer, Charles H. McGuire, based on the novel by Tom Clancy. Screenplay by W. Peter Iliff and Donald Stewart. Produced by Mace Neufeld and Robert Ramey. Directed by Philip Noyce. Our view slows and rises above the treetops to a vast gunmetal gray ocean stretching out to the horizon. Sheltered among the trees, a large white house with black shutters sits near the edge of a rocky cliff. In the driveway, a mailbox reads, The Ryans. Inside, we scan a spacious, elegant living room. Framed photos of an auburn-haired woman and a pixie-faced little girl rest on the lid of a grand piano. A painting of a military unit, a framed diploma, and a black-and-white photo of a smiling young officer.
Sorry, we can't come to the phone right now. If you'll leave a message, we'll get back to you as soon as we can. Thanks.
Hi, Mamie. It's Jack. We're going to leave London as planned, but we'll take a cab from the airport so nobody has to bother to drive in and pick us up.
In a hotel room, the pixie-faced 8-year-old girl plays Monopoly with her auburn-haired mother. The ruggedly handsome officer from the photo, now in his 40s, talks on the phone.
And listen, we completely forgot about Sally's goldfish. If by some miracle they're still alive, we feed them and change the water.
Mom will make my move, honey.
And if they're not, we go to the store and see if you can find a couple that are sort of the same size. Okay, we'll see you soon. Bye.
What's happening?
4, 5, 6!
Yes!
Oh, no.
Yay!
Another hotel?
What does he owe you?
You owe me 1,100 pounds.
I haven't got it. You win. I'm out.
This girl is rich.
I'm gonna go to sleep.
Later, the woman tiptoes into her sleeping daughter's bedroom, drops a gentle kiss on her forehead, and turns out the light. In the living room, her husband opens the door for a hotel bellhop.
Good evening, sir.
Yes? Will these do?
A cart with champagne and candles.
Bring it. My wife, I guess.
He grins sheepishly at the bellhop, who rolls in the cart. Later, the woman walks into the candlelit bedroom. She has dark eyebrows, full lips, and warm, strong features, and wears a silky, wine-colored nightgown. Her husband, wearing baggy boxer shorts, scrambles onto the bed with 2 glasses of champagne. He looks up and grins.
Candles. Champagne. Oh, honey. Sorry, I didn't think of this.
That's all right. Only one of us had to.
She takes a glass and slides in next to him.
She asleep?
Mm-hmm.
They sip their champagne, put their glasses on the nightstands next to the bed, and start to nuzzle.
What about your speech?
I'll wing it.
You sure?
Their lips melt together in a passionate kiss. The next day...
We have all watched, I think with a sense of awe, the protean events which have taken place in Moscow and the republics, and the enormous changes resulting from these events. In this volatile climate, then, I must conclude that we can only speculate on the future of Soviet fleet development and deployment. I would like to thank the trustees of the Royal Naval Academy for the very kind invitation to be here with you today.
Members of the audience rise to shake his hand. Now, a band of palace guards marches briskly down a London street. They wear long gray overcoats with brass buttons and tall furry black hats with gold-colored chin straps. The guards parade past the tall, ornate gates of Buckingham Palace. Spectators crowd the sidewalks on either side, craning their necks for a better view. Now, a guard stares straight ahead as the pixie-faced little girl tries to distract him. She leans from side to side, locking her eyes on his face and watching for a reaction. Her mother stands to the side, grinning and snapping pictures. Frustrated, the little girl breaks into a soft shoe dance. The guard ignores her.
He's impressed, Sally. He just can't show it. He's a professional soldier. It's his job not to be distracted. Come on, we gotta go meet Daddy.
Sally salutes.
I'm impressed.
Now, Sally's ruggedly handsome father, Jack, strides away from the naval club. Sally and her mom walk hand in hand down a sidewalk.
Find it on the map there?
Uh-huh. Good. Right here. And when we get to the street there, we turn left. No, right, yeah, right.
You sure?
Turn right, yes.
Okay, we're going to turn right. I'm following your map.
Okay, right.
20 yards away, three men wearing black caps sit in a parked car. One, a lean-faced 20-ish man with hard gray eyes, loads bullets into a handgun. He studies the boyish young man sitting next to him.
You mind your bottom, Paddy boy. Move sure and fast.
You told me that, didn't you?
So I'm telling you again. This won't be like anything you've ever done before, little brother.
Paddy shoots him a nervous grin.
Target leaving the palace now.
Right. Stay awake, lads. Here they come.
The blue-eyed, sharp-featured driver nods at them. Now, the palace guards raise their rifles and present arms as a gleaming black limousine pulls through the palace gates. Inside, a little blonde boy sits between his elegantly dressed mother and a distinguished 50-ish man with graying hair. In the parked car, the gunmen peer out the window as the chauffeured limousine rolls past. The blue-eyed driver pulls into the street behind them and yanks the black ski mask over his face. In back, the other men do the same. Now, Sally takes pictures of her mom. Across the street, Jack Ryan spots them and smiles. He waves and starts to cross. A black car, driven by a young red-haired woman, swerves into the path of the limo, blocking the road. The masked men pull up behind. Jack gapes as one gunman plants a bomb underneath the limo.
Down! Get down!
The gunman pulls the pin and runs. Jack bolts toward his family.
Get down!
He dives on top of them. The limo engine explodes in a pillar of flame. Jack hustles his family to cover.
Get down. Keep her down.
Huddled behind a parked car, he watches as Paddy and his brother riddle the limo drivers with bullets.
Get out of the car!
In back, the distinguished man tries to shield his family.
Open the fucking door!
Jack hesitates, then sprints toward the gunmen.
Open it or I'll blow it off!
He tackles him from behind and grabs his pistol. A bullet rips into Jack's shoulder, throwing him several feet back. He returns fire. Paddy jumps up. Jack shoots him in the chest. Paddy falls next to his brother.
Come on, let's go!
A third terrorist dives into the car as it takes off. The lean-faced gunman gapes at Paddy, whose blue eyes stare vacantly through his mask.
Buddy.
Trembling, he rolls onto his elbow and glares at the wounded Jack, who points the gun at him as he slumps to the ground. A guard aims a rifle at Jack, who takes his finger off the trigger. Now the blue-eyed driver rips off his mask and nervously scans the street as he drives away from the scene. Bleeding profusely from one shoulder, Jack blinks dazedly at Patty's brother. The lean-faced gunman shoots him an acid stare through his mask. A policeman yanks his head forward.
Help the boy.
Blood gushes from Patty's mouth as they pull off his mask.
He's had it.
The policeman lowers Patty's face into a pool of his own blood. Lips quivering with rage, his brother cranes his neck to stare at Jack, who struggles to focus his gaze on him. Now, Jack's wife and an older woman huddle protectively around Sally, whose body shakes with frightened sobs.
It's all right, sweetie. I want you to stay here. Everything's going to be okay.
She leaves her daughter in the arms of the older woman, then hurries across the street.
Stand back, please. Stand back, ma'am.
That's my husband. I'm a doctor. I'm going to treat him.
She pushes the rifle aside.
Oh, Jesus, Jack. What were you thinking of?
His shoulder is soaked with blood.
I'm going to set you down, okay?
She eases him to the ground.
Stay with me, Jack. You hear me? Stay with me. Jack, stay with me.
Later, blue lights flashing, an ambulance tears down the street, escorted by police cars. At the bomb site, investigators photograph the smoking, demolished limousine, while firemen clean up debris. A reporter stands in front of a camera.
The feeling here today is one of outrage over this unprecedented terrorist attack on the royal family. And while no group has yet claimed credit, there is among many here speculation already of Irish Republican Army involvement.
In a garage, the terrorists change license plates.
William Holmes, the Queen Mother's cousin and Minister of State for Northern Ireland, along with his wife and son, would have most certainly been killed were it not for the heroic efforts of this man, John Patrick Ryan, the American tourist who broke up the assassination attempt.
At CIA headquarters, two men watch the report.
And professor at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, Ryan is a former Marine lieutenant. Wounded in the exchange of gunfire, he is listed in guarded condition at an undisclosed London hospital. This is Deborah Weston, CNN News, London.
Now, in a hospital recovery room, Kathy Ryan sits by her husband's bedside, reading Jack's medical charts while he sleeps. Tubes and wires are taped to his right arm, while his left arm is wrapped in a sling. His eyes slowly blink open. He rolls his head on the pillow and sees his wife.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. You're alive. I forgive you. Otherwise...
She smiles gently at him. Sally pokes her head into the room with a worried smile.
Hey, pumpkin.
She waves. A nurse leads her away.
I love you.
I love you too.
Now, a sign reads HM Prison, Southwark. Inside, a detective interrogates Patty's older brother.
You dignified their cowardice with your silence. They left you. They drove off without you. I'm curious as to what it is you think you owe me.
If any of my mates ever drove off and left me in your hands, I not only feel no great sense of loyalty, I make sure to remind myself to kill them.
The gunman stares straight ahead.
Who are they, Sean? Where are they? The trip was unscheduled. How do you know Lord Holmes would be there?
Sean avoids Detective Hyland's penetrating gaze, his thin lips pressed tightly together. Owens, a tough-looking sergeant, stands in the back of the room, fidgeting.
I can't help if you don't talk to me, you know.
Hyland pats Sean's shoulder, starts toward the door, and shoots a quick, knowing look at Owens.
I'd tear your heart out and serve it up to you with chips. If I didn't know you'd enjoy it, you Fenian bastard.
Sean reels from Owens's hard slap. Now, in a pub, the blue-eyed driver sits with a burly bearded man.
No, not in all eternity. He'll not chirp a word. Not Sean Miller. And not while his brother is lying on a slab.
The bearded man scowls and shakes his head.
What's the matter, Jimmy? Don't you believe it? It's the entire thing I don't believe. The royal family, Kevin. You know that only turns people against us.
A woman with long, curly red hair and a leopard skin coat walks in. She smiled seductively at Jimmy.
Look, this was totally unauthorized. And the other brigade commanders, they know that you are behind it.
Fuck the bloody IRA. All these years of war and they've got us nowhere. In its heart and soul, England is still a monarchy. And that is where we must strike. At the royals and the ruling class. You're either with us or you're against us, Jimmy boy. Make up your mind.
Oh, I'm with you.
Good. That's all I wanted to hear.
Jimmy glances past him at the red-headed woman. The handsome, dark-haired driver grins.
I'll leave you to it.
He stands up to go.
Kevin. Charlie's going to drop by tonight to try to straighten things out. Be smart. Talk to him. And hold your temper.
I promise. Thanks, Jimmy.
Kevin smiles and walks out. Jimmy stands, slips a gold wedding band off his finger, and starts toward the red-haired woman. Now, a sprawling farmhouse stands in black silhouette against a ghostly midnight blue sky. Inside, Kevin sits unmoving in an armchair, transfixed by eerie, slow-motion images of riots and gunfire on television. Outside, three men carrying shotguns trudge up the hill toward the house. Kevin stares at the TV as if in a trance. A steaming cup of tea sits on the table beside him. In the video, we see a close-up of a singer's parted lips and tanks rolling down a street. Outside, two of the men crouch beneath Kevin's living room window. The third, wearing a drab coat and a brown knit cap, walks toward the front door, which is paned with frosted glass. He knocks with the butt of a pistol.
Kevin!
From behind his armchair, we see Kevin reach unhurriedly for his teacup. A hitman stalks through the house, gun raised.
Kevin, lad! It's me, Charlie!
On TV, a woman presses her hands together and bows her head in prayer. Outside, Charlie grins as he sees Kevin's shadow through the glass. Charlie slams to the ground. Carrying an automatic shotgun like a pistol, Kevin emerges from the house.
That's me holding my temper, Jimmy boy.
With a duffel bag slung over one shoulder, he steps over Charlie's corpse and walks toward his car. Now Jimmy collapses on a bed, naked, with the red-haired woman on top of him. Jimmy closes his eyes as the woman trails her mouth down his chest and stomach. Wearing a black lace bra, panties, and garter belt, the woman works her way back up his body, flicking her tongue across his bare skin. He rolls on top of her.
Oh, damn. Oh, God.
What?
Where's my bag?
She gets out of bed.
Oh, you're not going to make me wear a rubber, are you? You know, the church says wearing one of them's a sin, darling.
So is this, darling.
Jimmy hits the pillows, two bullet holes in his forehead. With a triumphant smile, the woman tucks the pistol into her bag and unpins her long red wig, revealing shoulder-length black hair. Leaving Jimmy's naked corpse sprawled on the bed, she puts on her leopard skin coat and leaves. Outside, a sign above the inn's door reads, O'Dwyer's. The woman climbs into a parked car and greets Kevin with a passionate kiss. Now, Owens and Hyland sit with Jack in his hospital room while he leafs through mugshots.
So what can you tell me about... About this guy?
Sean? Oh, he's a nice boy, Sean Miller. Shot a parish priest in Derry. During confession, if you can imagine.
He thought the father was informing for the British.
Excuse me, Sergeant, I don't think it's in Mr. Ryan's best interests or the prosecution's to discuss matters not directly related to the events at hand. If you can confirm for me that the man in that photograph is the same man you disarmed in the square, I think we'll be through.
I can.
Do you have anything to add, Mr. Ryan?
Yes. The man I killed was Miller's...
brother.
Brother.
Patrick. Not even 17, Paddy boy.
Recruited by Sean into the IRA...
Again, I think we'd all be better served if we could preserve the clarity of your eventual testimony.
I read it in the newspaper. I can hardly see.
I'd appreciate you refraining from reading the newspapers.
Not even Doonesbury?
Do you have anything to add?
Now, a newspaper headline reads, Terrorist Trial, Hero's Testimony Today. A passerby grabs the paper on his way into an imposing courthouse with tall marble pillars. Inside, with a guard gripping each arm, Sean Miller walks down a stark, dingy corridor. Now, Jack and Kathy wait in a wood-paneled witness room. An elegant, hawk-nosed man strides in.
Mr. Ryan.
Yes.
My name's Jeffrey Watkins, Principal Private Secretary to Lord Howe.
Pleasure to meet you. This is my wife, Catherine.
How do you do?
Hello.
So, Dr. Ryan, how is your patient healing?
Just fine. We're looking forward to going home, though.
I can imagine. May I introduce his lordship?
Hello.
It's my great honor to finally meet you, Dr. Ryan.
Thank you.
I owe you a debt of gratitude that I shall never be able to repay.
Not at all. Thank you for your kind note.
Now, Sean and his guards emerge into a courtroom, divided by wooden partitions into separate stalls. Sean hesitates, gulps hard, and slumps into a chair in the prisoner's box, in the witness room.
I'm delighted that you're here to share in the good news, Mrs. Ryan. Her Majesty's decided to invest your husband, Casey Vio, Knight Commander of the Victorian Order.
The Ryans break into stunned grins.
My congratulations, sir. And good luck today.
Everyone in the room stands at attention as Lord Holmes walks out.
Sir Jack.
Lady Catherine.
With dignified nods, they settle into their chairs, then share a bemused look. Later, Jack takes the witness stand.
Perhaps, if I'd had more time to think about it, I would have preferred to do something else.
So you're saying you didn't have time, is that it?
That's correct.
So you didn't.
Didn't what?
Think, sir. You didn't think is the point I believe you're trying to make. No. Instead, you raced into a situation of which, by your own admission, you had no understanding. Attacked my client, who was, in fact, another pedestrian hurrying to help.
Wearing a ski mask.
Shot a second man in the chest, this one taking you, can it be?
After
three
they
shots
shot
at
me.
Point-blank range in order to fell the second victim.
I used that force I deemed necessary.
I should say so. And doubt very much whether anyone in this courtroom would disagree.
Excuse me. I didn't make this happen, sir.
No further questions.
He did.
Oh, my lord, there is one more question. Are you still, Dr. Ryan, in the paid service of the Central Intelligence Agency? I should remind you that you're under oath.
Jack tenses. Kathy watches him.
No.
I beg your pardon?
No.
That's all. Thank you.
The witness may stand down.
Sean's eyes narrow with hatred at Jack.
Thank you.
Jack starts back to his seat. Sean lunges as he walks past.
Bloody proud of yourself, aren't you?
You wasn't where I didn't belong. Now you've killed my baby brother.
Jack stares at him coldly as two guards wrestle Sean away. He slides into a bench next to Kathy and Owens, then watches uneasily as Sean is dragged out of the courtroom. Jack turns and forces a reassuring smile at Kathy, who frowns soberly. Another day. A taxicab rolls down a sun-dappled country road, lined on both sides with pastures and farmland. In a small glassy pond, we see the reflection of the Ryan's house, as the cab pulls into the pebble driveway. Wearing a jaunty plaid cap with a pom-pom and a striped sweater, Sally jumps out and points a video camera at her parents.
Hey, Daddy!
Hey, pumpkin.
Now she wanders into her bedroom and smiles at two plump goldfish swimming in a tank.
You guys have really grown.
Kathy lights a fire in a flagstone fireplace, then straightens up with a weary sigh. She slips off her suit jacket and turns on a stereo. She takes a stack of mail off a cabinet and freezes. Her mouth gapes open. His left arm in a sling, Jack unpacks a suitcase. Kathy shuffles in.
How are you feeling?
Not so good.
Tired?
No.
I have no idea what time it is. Feels like morning to me.
You're telling me.
He glances at her with a baffled frown.
Did I miss something?
No. But I did.
He stares at her.
I'm pregnant.
Jack's face lights up. They hug tightly. Sally walks in.
Can I watch some TV? I'm not at all tired.
She looks suspiciously at her beaming parents.
What?
Later, in the kitchen.
Plates.
I don't have any say in this, do I?
Sure you do, honey. This is a family. Everybody's got a say.
Well, my say is after the fact. Or am I wrong?
No. You're right.
Michaela really despises her little sister.
Yeah? Well, ready for this? It could be even worse. It could be baby brother.
Oh, no. Boys.
A white-haired man on TV.
Jack.
True, boys are...
You, in fact, deny that the provisional wing of the IRA was behind this assassination attempt.
When
the
IRA... Jack distractedly hands silverware to Sally.
...form of campaign, they admit to it.
Thank you.
That's the policy. They'll proudly say they did it. Have the IRA admitted to this? I mean, common sense, logic, some form of reason.
They at least suggest some names.
Jack frowns tightly and turns off the television.
Sure you can, honey.
Now, in a dark, narrow prison cell, sitting as if in a trance, Sean Miller stares at a newspaper clipping taped to the wall. It carries a photo of Jack and the headline, Hero Saves Royal Cousin. In the picture, a younger Jack wears a marine uniform and white cap. Sean slowly leans his head back against the concrete wall. Now, outside a shopping arcade, wearing a stylish gray suit, the young woman with the long red wig walks into a store filled with antique books.
Morning, Mr. Cooley.
A balding man with glasses.
And to you, madam. How's business?
Fine, thank you. I came upon this first edition at an estate auction. Can your man restore it?
He finds a handwritten note inside the book.
And when would you want this by, madam?
Soon.
It reads, Miller Sentencing Route.
As you can see, it's very pressing.
I'm not sure. The binder may have some trouble with this.
Is that so?
I'll see what I can do. He's not a miracle worker, you know.
No, obviously he's not, Mr. Cooley.
He gazes fearfully at her.
The best you can arrange, then.
He nods reluctantly.
Good day, Mr. Cooley.
Good day, madam.
She walks to the door with a quick warning look over one shoulder. He frowns beneath his mustache and starts to write. Nighttime. Carrying two cups of coffee, Inspector Hyland climbs into the back of a prison van.
Hello, Sean. Don't mind if I come along with you, do you?
He hands a cup to Sean through the bars of a tiny cell. Sean takes it without smiling. Hyland settles onto a bench next to two constables, then grins triumphantly at his prisoner. Surrounded by six unmarked police cars, three vans with flashing blue lights pull out of the prison yard. The vehicles split into three groups, each with one van and two escorts. They all drive in different directions. In Hyland's van, Sean stares into space, his cuffed hands dangling loosely in his lap. He ignores Hyland, who studies him through the bars of his cell.
Although I disapprove of the things you've done, Sean, I can't quite bring myself to condemn you.
Sean's grey eyes stay hard and unblinking.
I can't. Because I understand where the hatred comes from. I more than understand it. But the present fact is that we're very near now the darkest hole in all of Great Britain. And you still won't speak to me.
Hyland leans his face close to the bars with a contemptuous sneer. Sean ignores him. Hyland gives up and leans his back against the wall of the van. Flanked front and back by police cars, the van stops in front of a dark, deserted drawbridge. Inside, Sean shifts his eyes as the van jolts to a stop.
Understood.
Hyland leans his head back wearily. He glances over at Sean, who meets his gaze with the hint of a smile. Hyland sneers. The van pitches violently as the police cars explode into sheets of flame. Panting, Hyland grits his teeth and glares at Sean, who grins fiendishly. Now, Annette, the red-wigged assassin, steers a boat along the shadowy channel toward the bridge. Kevin and three gunmen surround the van.
Open the door! Open it or I'll kill him!
For the bridge keeper!
What do we do?
We open the door.
Open it! But for Christ's sake,
but what?
Wait until they kill him, then open the door.
His lips curl in rage. A constable opens the van door. Kevin points a pistol at them.
Your guns!
We are unarmed!
Just who the hell are you?
Get them out!
The gunmen drag Hyland and the remaining constable out of the van, hurl them face down on the pavement, then force the frail, white-haired bridge keeper to join them.
Second round! Don't you fucking move!
I think we'd forget about you, did you?
Come on, the car.
Kevin frees Sean from his handcuffs. They climb out of the van.
Inspector Robert Hyland. This is a friend of mine.
We meet at last, Mr. Hyland. Tell me, what did they pay you to turn against your own people? Eh?
Get on with it and be on your way.
Very well. If that's the way you feel about it.
Kevin kneels, the muzzle of his pistol pressed against Hyland's cheek. He stands up and aims, then hesitates. Looks at Sean and hands over the gun. Hyland tries to look up. Sean grinds his foot into his back. Sean stares down at his victims, then runs off with the other gunmen. Standing amid clouds of swirling black smoke, Kevin surveys the bodies and the twisted, flaming wreckage of the police cars. Then he strides away. Now, at the Ryans, hunched against a blustery wind, Jack strolls onto the front porch and sips a mug of coffee. Sally dashes out, carrying her video camera.
Come on, Kath.
Kathy follows as Jack and Sally head for his station wagon.
Have I got the tickets or what? Honey, there's plenty of time.
Kathy runs back into the house. Jack gives Sally a reassuring grin, then turns. A black sedan rounds a corner on the winding dirt road leading to their house. Squinting against the wind, he watches the car pull into their driveway. A tall 50-ish man with a close-shaven beard climbs out, along with a barrel-chested black man with graying hair. Both wear tan trench coats over their suits. The barrel-chested man smiles and shakes Jack's hand.
Morning, Jack. You know Marty Kenner.
Marty? How's the shoulder?
Not too bad.
Admiral Greer waves at Kathy, who tries to smile.
Something's come up? Can we sit down and have a chat?
Sally trudges back into the house. Later.
They were moving him to Albany Prison on the Isle of Wight when it happened. We think he's left the country.
Marty, excuse me. Let's deal in what we know, not what we don't. We know he's escaped. We know it happened in Kent, near the Channel. If he's left the country... Jack, you listening? The chances he'd come here, that he'd try, that he could come here, are so remote, I have trouble even saying it.
And yet your first instinct was to come all the way out here and tell me.
Marty, want to excuse us a few minutes?
Marty glances from the Admiral to Jack, then walks to the study door. Greer frowns soberly at Jack. Outside, Kathy sits on a porch swing, watching her disgruntled daughter playing with a Game Boy. She looks up as Marty walks onto the porch and meets his friendly smile with a level stare. She closes her eyes and heaves a deep sigh. Inside.
I've got a few more weeks before school starts, but I've got to dig in and prepare a few lectures.
Want to come down and look over what we got? You might turn up something we haven't.
You're asking me if I want to come back.
The Admiral smiles.
Yep.
Later, bundled in hats and coats, Kathy and Sally wheel their bicycles out of a shed. Jack intercepts them.
We'll try and go next week, honey.
All right.
Sorry. Sean Miller escaped.
Well, what does that mean?
They just wanted me to know. They thought I might be concerned. I'm not. The IRA's not stupid. They're not going to follow me all the way over here. We talked about it. They agreed. They're gone. That's it.
They didn't ask you to come back to CIA?
I said no.
Just like that.
I don't want to go back, honey.
Wind tugging at her hair, Kathy studies Jack's face with a skeptical frown.
I saw them coming and I just...
I know.
I can't go back to that life again. You know?
Kathy walks away. Jack doesn't move.
Sally! Wait up, honey.
Jack turns and trudges back toward the house, hands buried in the pockets of his jeans. Now, in the middle of an ocean, a massive freighter churns through the waves, cutting a swath of white foam. On board, a group of Kevin's men lounge on narrow cots, crammed together in a storeroom lit by a single bulb.
I bet your cell was even better than this. Bloody Ritz in comparison.
At least you always had your own toilet bowl, eh, Sean?
Come on, Sean, cheer up. You've just been spared a lifetime of hell on Earth. A word of gratitude might even be in order.
I don't feel like resting. Laying around in the sun like some complacent tourist.
If we're to build an army, we've got to train like soldiers. And we can't do that in Ireland, not now.
Bleeding waste of time.
There's laying about and there's laying low. There's a difference.
Is there?
It's Lord Holmes who should be worried about complacency. Next time he won't be so lucky. Post him back to Whitehall in little pieces, if that's what it takes to free every Irish political prisoner.
That's not what I'm thinking of.
I know that, Sean. But what Ryan done can't be undone. So you should stop thinking about him.
I can't.
Now, in Lord Holmes's chambers, he paces back and forth in front of Watkins, his private secretary, and Sergeant Owens.
How in the world could something like this have happened?
Inspector Harland picked the day, picked the decoy routes, picked the men, and still they knew.
He had two children, apparently.
It's tragic. Tragic.
SO-13 have narrowed it down to 31 people who had prior knowledge of your itinerary on the day of the attack and of Miller's transfer. Five of whom are now dead.
Sir, I think it might be best if we limit your appointments for the time being.
I will not have my itinerary dictated to me by terrorists.
Whoever this traitor is, I better pray to God I never find him.
We know you'll do your best, Sergeant.
A smile flickers across Owens's coarse features. Now our view flies over choppy gray waves toward a manicured field and a massive complex of tall, blockish gray buildings. A subtitle, U.S. Naval Academy, Annapolis, Maryland. Lined up in precise rows, young cadets wearing Navy sweatshirts jog down a street.
Guest appealed to Athens on what basis? On what grounds?
Jack, in class.
Mr. Biederman? Bad time for you?
Well, they said they'd be grateful.
Didn't they?
Uh-huh. Two female students grin at each other.
Uh-huh. Fight our battle and the rest of the world will fear and respect you.
Yeah, but didn't the rest of the world fear and respect Athens already?
Didn't matter.
Didn't matter? Why not?
Pride, sir?
That's the battle they lost. The real battle.
Attention on deck.
Attention to orders.
A commander.
I have a presentation to make. For service above and beyond the call of duty of a tourist, even a Marine, we recognize Professor John Patrick Ryan with the Order of the Purple Target and hope that he will duck next time lest he become part of history. Rather than a teacher of it.
He drapes a medal with the words, shoot me, around Jack's neck, then gives him a bear hug. Now, in a hospital.
How old is he?
10.
Plate glass window?
Mm-hmm.
Wearing surgical scrubs, Kathy enters an operating room.
Here we go.
Hi, guys.
She studies a video image of a lacerated eyeball.
I got a retina at 1 o'clock. We might have to bump it. This could take some time. Yep, let's bump it.
We're all set to go.
Okay, let's do it.
At the academy.
So, you just waded on in like John Wayne. Why'd you do it? What were you thinking, man?
Ryan shrugs his eyebrows.
I don't know. I wasn't thinking.
That's it? You sound like some of my students.
Jack stares into space. Then nods to himself.
Just pissed me off. I couldn't just stand there and watch him shoot those people right in front of me. It was rage. Pure rage. Just made me mad.
Well, he's hoping you never get mad at me, man.
Later, Kathy strips off her surgical gloves and checks her watch. Now, outside an elementary school, wearing the same blue blazer, white gloves, and yellow beret as her classmates, Sally skips along a stone wall.
Okay, now it's my turn. She's late,
Sean. Cradling a submachine gun in his lap, Sean Miller waits across the street in an unmarked van. He ignores his companion and narrows his eyes at Sally. At the academy, Jack walks out of a building, along with dozens of uniformed officers. Now, Sally sits on the wall with the other little girls.
And then she was at her dance, and then this guy, at the end, he...
She puckers her lips.
Kind of cute, isn't she? Is she?
Sean looks up from his map and frowns into the rearview mirror. A forest green Porsche rolls past and pulls up to the curb in front of the school. Bye. Sally jumps off the wall and runs to her mom.
Hi, Mommy. How are you?
Let's do it.
They start to follow Kathy's car. A crossing guard stops them. The young girl stands directly in front of them with a stop sign while her uniformed schoolmates cross the street. Sean fidgets as Kathy's Porsche turns a corner. He consults his map.
Highway 50, west.
Now, Jack walks out of the academy's main gate. He nods to a uniformed guard. He waits for a truck to turn a corner. When it passes, he steps forward and freezes. Across the street, a young blonde man wearing an Annapolis sweatshirt loiters at the curb, fidgeting from foot to foot. Jack tenses. The young man turns his back, reaches into his sweatshirt, then buys a newspaper from a vending machine. With a relieved smile, Jack starts across the street, his eyes glued to the young man's retreating back. He jerks his head around and stares at a Jeep, double parked several yards away. The driver's face is hidden in shadows, backlit by the late afternoon sun. Jack frowns anxiously and keeps walking. At ground level, the young man's Nike sneakers step in front of us. Hands hidden beneath his sweatshirt, he trails Jack at a discreet distance. Jack glances at the window of a delivery van and sees the young man's reflection. His eyes dart around in panic. He walks faster. Behind him, the young man keeps pace. In the street, the Jeep creeps alongside them. Suddenly, Jack drops his briefcase and dives behind a parked truck. The young man yanks out a pistol, peers cautiously around a corner of the truck, and scans the empty street. He turns around. Jack jumps out and slugs him. The gunman drops his pistol. He slams Jack against the truck, punches him in the face, and lunges for his weapon. The assassin drops, shot through the chest. Navy guards run toward them, guns drawn. Jack sees a red-headed woman peel away in the Jeep. He grabs the young man by the shirt.
Where's Sean Miller? Where's Sean Miller?
The assassin smiles contemptuously through blood-stained teeth. Then his head sags to the ground. Blood dripping from his nose and lip, Jack gapes in panic and sprints to his station wagon. He yanks open the door and reaches for his mobile phone.
Yeah, Dr. Catherine Ryan, please.
Dr. Ryan, are you all right?
How long?
Dr. Ryan?
Jack ignores the guard.
Come on! Come on!
He tears out of his parking space and down the quaint, narrow street, leaving clouds of dust behind him. Now, Kathy and Sally turn onto a highway on-ramp. A sign reads, Bay Bridge. Jack swerves crazily down the street. He picks up his phone. In Kathy's car.
Surgery.
Yes, this is Dr. Ryan. I'd like the results on the Thompson boys' retinal scan.
Hold, please.
Come on, Kathy, get off the phone.
From high above, we watch Jack's car race through the winding streets of Annapolis. Now Sally holds up an art project covered in pink and orange tissue paper.
Look, Mom. Oh, it's beautiful.
Are you still holding?
Yes, I'm still holding. Look, I'd like to speak with Dr. Sutton.
Sean Miller's maroon van turns onto the on-ramp. Keeping a tight grip on his submachine gun, he scans the concrete four-lane highway, crowded with rush hour traffic. Clutching his mobile phone, Jack enters the highway from a different on-ramp.
Operator, I want to make an emergency breakthrough. The number is 555-3464. Yeah, it's a mobile phone here. What do you mean I can't?
The van, equipped with a handicap license plate, weaves in and out of traffic.
Foster, dammit!
Without slowing down, it cuts back and forth across all four lanes, barely missing other cars. Jack zigzags recklessly through traffic.
Dr. Ryan, we have the results of that retinal scan and everything is fine.
That's great. Thank you.
Kathy hangs up. Now, Jack tries to lurch around a stop-and-go traffic jam. Craning his neck to glare at the cars behind him, Jack swerves in and out of the lanes.
Hello?
Kathy.
Jack?
Kath, something's happened, honey. Is Sally with you?
Yeah.
Hi, Dad.
Is everything all right?
Yeah, everything's fine.
Sean's van pulls within three car lengths behind her.
There she is.
Right.
The Porsche switches to the left lane. They follow it.
Honey, I want you to get off the highway and get to the nearest police station as quick as you can, all right?
the police station.
Kathy, just get off the highway right now.
The van creeps up beside her in the breakdown lane.
Steady, Meg. Steady.
Sean opens the side door.
Where are you now?
I'm at Sabro Boulevard.
There's a state police barracks at Houston Street.
I'll meet you there.
Okay. Something wrong, Mom?
No, everything's fine. It's okay.
Kathy glances over her shoulder. A third car tries to pass her on the left, cutting off the van. Sean aims. Its back window blown out, the Porsche speeds toward a concrete divider. Several other cars crash into the demolished Porsche.
They're gone.
Black smoke pours from the wreckage. Sean's van turns around and drives in the opposite direction, right past Jack, who doesn't see it as he stares blankly at the traffic jam. Suddenly, Jack spots the smoke less than a mile ahead. Gaping, he jerks up in his seat. We see a close-up of his green eyes, wide with panic as they slowly fill with tears. The scene dissolves to a helicopter hovering overhead, its rotor blades a spinning blur against a dusky violet sky. Its doors read Life Flight. The chopper lowers onto a landing pad marked with the letter H. Emergency medical technicians and doctors in scrub suits rush in with stretchers. They slide Kathy and Sally out of the back. Both are immobilized with straps, barely conscious and smeared with blood. Later, wearing a dazed, anxious scowl, Jack paces back and forth in a waiting room. He holds an ice pack to his cheek. A tall, dark-haired doctor with a surgical mask around his neck stops at a nursing station. A nurse motions toward Jack.
Mr. Ryan?
Yeah.
Your wife's okay. She sustained a concussion, but we ran a complete skull protocol.
She's pregnant.
I know. The baby's okay, so you don't have to worry about
it. What about my daughter?
Let's sit down for a moment.
No, talk to me.
It's going to be a little while before we know. Maybe in the morning.
Later, in a recovery room, Jack sits by Kathy's bedside, gently stroking her hair away from her scarred, bloody forehead. An angry purple bruise covers her eye and cheek. Kathy's eyes slowly blink open. Jack tries to smile through trembling lips. His wife swallows back tears.
Where's Sally?
She's in the recovery room, honey. You're watching her. We'll know in 7 or 8 hours. They had to remove her spleen. She's in pretty bad shape.
I'm sorry.
Her face twisted with grief, Kathy leans up and wraps her arms around Jack, who hugs her tightly. Later, Jack stands outside Sally's recovery room, staring unblinkingly through the window. Sally lies unconscious in bed, with tubes, filters, and wires connected to her arms and head. Jack stands unmoving, his eyes slowly brim over with tears, which roll down his cheeks. The next morning, Jack stares out the window of the waiting room. Outside, reporters gather on the helipad.
Here you go.
On a fundraising tour.
You okay?
Jack takes a cup of coffee from Robbie, his commander friend. Robbie and his wife watch with worried frowns as Jack paces away from them. On TV, the white-haired spokesman appears. Jack glares at the screen.
Recovery of the victims of this senseless attack. Sinn Féin are outraged, as indeed are most Irish Catholics this morning at this heinous crime.
Jack stalks to the window. Patty O'Neill is being interviewed on the helipad.
Our empathy and anguish, but I will wait as I feel
proper for the most appropriate time.
Yeah, but can you confirm or deny that funding for the IRA is...
The IRA are not responsible for this attack.
Jack shakes his head in disgust and turns away from the window. The tall, dark-haired surgeon walks into the waiting room and greets Jack with a tired smile.
She's going to be okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Later, Jack emerges from an elevator.
Mr. Ryan.
O'Neill tries to follow him.
Mr. Ryan, I'd like to share with you our deep regret about...
Jack whirls, points a warning finger at him, and keeps walking.
Mr. Ryan.
Jack slams out of the hospital, escorted by a bodyguard in a tan trench coat. The blue-eyed 60-ish O'Neill arches his eyebrows with a resigned sigh, his lean face and sunken cheeks etched with deep lines. Now our view climbs over a forest of bare trees and rises above a massive rectangular building lined with hundreds of windows. Jack strides purposefully through the front doors. An emblem of an eagle is carved into the marble floor beneath the words Central Intelligence Agency. Jack pauses, scans the spacious lobby, and takes a deep breath. Now in Marty Cantor's office.
You know the deal, Jack. Come on. You are involved.
Don't
that is not good
deal.
Process.
Deal.
You are the victim of a crime, and that does not make for the best analysis. Even if you knew something about terrorism, which you do not. I have guys on it. Guys who know something
Marty,
about
I
the
am
art.
Not standing here.
This is not naval.
Marty, I am not standing here with my hat in my hand. I am telling you, I want back in.
Jack?
Sir.
Thank God about Sally. Alice and I are relieved beyond words. You manage any sleep?
Not much, sir.
I'm interrupting something. You were explaining to Jack about how we'd be better off without him around here. Or something along those lines.
Greer retreats into his office. Jack shoots Marty a lopsided grin. Later, in a large room crowded with desks, a sign reads, Terrorism Assessments.
Mark Spiva, Jack Ryan, Tony Farrow, hi, Alex Winter,
Jack, Rose.
Well,
Rose,
I have to say you're looking better than I expected.
It's an illusion, I'm afraid.
Of course it would have to be, wouldn't it? Well, it's good to see you again regardless. Look, we've carved a niche for you, and here's your night table reading.
My.
The tidy gray-haired Rose rests her hands on a foot-tall stack of files. Later, outside a room full of monitors and computers, Jack props his feet up on a desk as he reads through the files. A dozen black-and-white photos lie scattered on the floor next to him. His shirt rumpled and sleeves rolled up, Jack flips through a document marked Secret, then frowns down at the pictures of IRA terrorists, his eyes shifting in thought. Many of the files are stamped with the codename Patriot. He rummages through his pile of notes, then stoops over and picks up the mugshot of Sean Miller. He turns it over and reads the label on the back.
Father killed by RUC. Belfast, 1979.
Now, a subtitle. Belfast, Northern Ireland. At a barricaded checkpoint, a guard stops a car.
Good morning, sir. Cut the engine, please. Can I see some form of identification, please?
The driver hands an ID to the guard, who wears a bulletproof vest. On the sidewalk, boys play soccer while soldiers with machine guns patrol the street. Spray-painted graffiti reads, Free Ireland. Kick out the Brits. Now, Sergeant Owens and a squad of policemen charge up the hallway stairs of a brick apartment building. One officer kneels in front of a door and switches on a tiny television monitor. Inside the dark, dingy apartment, two men hunch over a table, assembling explosives. A tube-like fiber-optic camera snakes under the apartment door. Outside, his pistol ready, Owens watches the monitor as the camera officer scans the apartment. Owens points to the right. The officer moves the thin black tube. The men appear on screen, and two others join them at the table. Owens taps the officer on the shoulder and holds out four fingers. The officer nods. The signal passes back to the half-dozen policemen crouched in the stairwell. The officer yanks his camera out from under the door. Owens stands back. A mustached policeman swings at the door with a sledgehammer.
What the hell?
Hey, nobody move!
The police hurl the IRA soldiers to the floor with savage force. One raises his arms in surrender.
Morning.
At the CIA.
Kevin O'Donnell, longtime IRA strategist, friend of the Miller family. He was there when Timothy Miller was killed, 79. Looked after his boys, Sean and Patrick. This photo's not a year old. I think if we could find O'Donnell, we'll find Miller still standing at his side. Are you with me, Jack?
Yeah, I'm just thinking.
Jack frowns into space while the others take notes.
What kind of question?
Son of a bitch.
What?
He points to his notes.
SO-13 gets an anonymous tip about some bomb-like stuff on a table in an apartment. They go in, they get some IRA bad guys, they look around, they see there's no way anybody could have seen through the window like the tipster said.
Photos of Charlie Dugan's corpse.
We got three IRA hitmen at a farmhouse hit by somebody else.
That's British soldiers getting out of hand, Jack. They're not above it, not after a hit on the royal family.
No. Look. We got brigade commander of the IRA, Jimmy O'Riordan. Checks into a cheap hotel room, ends up dead. Double tap to the head. Very professional. And that was how long after the farmhouse?
Same day.
What are you coming to, Jack?
Jack frowns in confusion and starts toward the door.
Jack?
Where are you going? I'm just going to go throw some water on your face.
Marty and the others exchange skeptical glances. Shoulders hunched and clothes rumpled, Jack stalks into the stark, modern hallway. He pauses at the bathroom door and does a double take at a young, dark-haired woman, then frowns and goes in. A silver-haired security guard shuffles past. In the bathroom, Jack glances in the mirror and freezes. A flashback to the IRA assassin's reflection in the van window. Jack blinks, turns away, and swallows hard. He moves to the sink and stares at his reflection in the mirror. He sees the bullet hit the assassin. His brow furrows as he replays his memory. A slow-motion, close-up flashback of a woman driving past in the Jeep. A cap covers her long red hair. The image dissolves to Jack's staring eyes. A young red-haired woman comes out of a stall.
Excuse me. I think one of us is in the wrong room. That's okay.
Jack hurries out with a sheepish grin. He starts toward the terrorist center, then pauses and turns back just as the young woman steps out of the bathroom. She sees him staring, smiles shyly, and walks away. A flashback to the exploding limo and the shootout. As if in a trance, Jack stares at the young woman's long red hair. He remembers the long red ponytail of a woman in the car that blocked the limo. Lips tight in a determined frown, Jack hurries back to his desk.
We didn't get any prints or anything like that.
Listen,
so we're kind of at a loss.
Who are we looking for here, huh? IRA terrorists or some ultra-violent faction of the IRA fighting the cause their way?
He shuffles through his notes.
Jimmy O'Riordan checked into a hotel with a woman with long hair. Long red hair. This is who we should be looking for. We find her. We'll find him.
He holds up a picture of Kevin O'Donnell with the woman, her back to us. Now, Sean leans out the window of a helicopter as it flies over a barren, sun-scorched desert. Wind rakes through his short blonde hair. The sand below is sculpted into mountainous dunes. Our view rises and dips with the chopper's flight. The sand-beige helicopter flies over a small cluster of tents. A subtitle appears, North Africa. Wearing khakis and a sweat-soaked shirt, Kevin watches the chopper touch down behind the camp, blowing clouds of sand into the air. Annette smiles and waves out the open door. Two soldiers wearing fatigues and red berets help her and Sean onto the sand. Annette runs to Kevin and greets him with a passionate kiss. Sean trudges behind her.
I saw his wife and daughter die. But she and Nettie blew it. Ryan's still alive.
They're not dead, Sean.
What?
Mr. Boyfist, I can't say it any plainer than that. It doesn't matter. The trip served its purpose.
It does matter.
Sean shoves between them and stalks toward a mesh-sided tent. Annette and Kevin look at each other, then follow him in. Sean flings his bag onto a cot.
Sean, Americans hold their breath every time a little girl falls down a pipe in the backyard. But you shot at one with a submachine gun on the way back from school.
Well, we've started the bleeding war. The Brits are tearing apart Belfast for the IRA. And their American money are denying the hit so loud. It only makes them look more guilty.
The war is raging. And when it's over, we'll be the only ones left standing. Sean, I'll let you go for Paddy Boy. But that's it.
Sean stomps out.
We've got work to do. And it's not in Maryland.
Sean ignores him and keeps walking. Now at the Ryans, a half dozen workmen crawl around the exterior of the house on ladders, installing wires for a security system. Two agents in tan trench coats stand on the porch, sipping cups of coffee. Jack's station wagon pulls into the driveway and parks in front of the house. Kathy climbs stiffly out the passenger door. Carrying her suitcase, Jack takes her arm and helps her up the stairs. He nods at the agents.
Hello.
Kathy smiles politely at the men, then steps inside. She pauses in the foyer, gazing around the empty house with worn, dark-ringed eyes. Jack puts an arm around her shoulders and kisses her forehead. She leans into him and walks in. Later, Jack sits dozing at his desk, loosely holding a glass of scotch. His right hand rests on a document which reads, Central Intelligence Agency, Sean Miller Escape.
Yeah?
How's the family, Ryan? Nearly lost them, didn't you? It's easy to get at them. You should look after your family better, you know.
Wearing pajamas, Kathy pads in.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Understand your little girl's feeling better, eh? Lost her spleen, though, yeah? Pity that. Make it mighty tough on her to fight off infection, eh, Jackie?
You sick son of a bitch.
Shaking with rage, he glares at the phone.
It was him, wasn't it? He's never gonna leave us alone.
Jack crosses the room and strokes her hair.
Don't ever get that close to us again, honey. This boy's making calls in the middle of the night. That's all we can do.
You get him, Jack. I don't care what you have to do. Just get him.
She pulls away and walks out of the room. Jack bows his head. Nighttime in a crowded, smoky Irish pub.
Here's to you, my brave Irish laddies. We'll not be broken, downhearted and sad.
Closely shadowed by the tall, broad-shouldered Robbie, Jack pushes through the crowd and confronts Paddy O'Neill, who sits at a table with a priest.
Can I buy you a drink?
No. Let me buy you one.
Jack follows him to the bar.
Barney, two whiskeys.
O'Neill nods at two empty bar stools, his sharp-featured, weathered face pale above his brown leather jacket. He sits next to Jack.
The IRA is not responsible for all this, I know that.
Are you waiting for me to agree with you? I've been saying this to the press till I'm blue in the face.
That's the point, isn't it? Claim responsibility for one thing, deny it for another. Nobody believes you anymore. I want to know where Sean Miller and Kevin O'Donnell are.
He grins in disbelief.
Let me try and understand this. You want me to sell out my fellow Irishmen to you? Is that why you came down here? You don't understand me at all.
Oh, I think I do.
Look,
I don't give a damn what they've done. But the day that I sell out my countrymen will be the day that I put a bullet through my own head.
That's it then, huh?
That's it. You know what? Second thoughts, maybe I won't have a drink with you.
Okay, then I'll go home.
Have a safe trip.
I'll go home and call the TV stations. Give them what they want. Let them take their cameras into my daughter's hospital room. Put it on the evening news.
I don't give a shit whether you did it or not, and neither will anyone else. But I will put such a stranglehold on your gun money, you'll be out in the street throwing rocks. I will fucking destroy you. I will make it my mission in life.
Jack shoves past him and storms out. Robbie bumps O'Neill's shoulder.
Excuse me.
Hey, lads, did you hear that?
Now at the North African camp, O'Donnell's soldiers stand in a row, target training with assault rifles, machine guns, and pistols. Annette and an Arab trainer walk behind them, giving advice. Sean fires his submachine gun at a human silhouette and blasts holes in its chest. The trainer gives him a thumbs up, then checks his watch. Everyone dashes for their tents except Sean, who keeps firing.
Get inside!
Sean riddles the target's head with bullets, then runs for cover. Now at CIA headquarters.
So, SO-13 traced the weapons used in the Lord Holmes incident to an arms dealer that supplies Gaddafi. Now, when Sean Miller escaped, he was last seen in a Zodiac heading out into the channel in a gale, which didn't make much sense until I checked on the freighters that were out there that day. Syrian registry, known to carry arms from the Middle East to client states in the Mediterranean, including Gaddafi.
So, Miller takes a slow boat to North Africa.
Exactly. Now, we send our birds up over the desert, photographing what? How many camps?
182.
182 camps a day in North Africa. Libyan bases, PLO, Red Brigade, Action Direct, West German Red Army faction. But on the day that this particular ship docked in Benghazi, there's activity in only 9 camps with people arriving. Now, this one we know for sure is PLO. This one's Shining Path. These 7 we're not so sure about.
Why? Well, we've got satellites and...
Well, because the people in those camps know probably better than we do exactly what time the satellite's going to pass overhead.
Aerial photos of the camps.
And Marty, unless you authorize us to retask those satellites so we can get a look before they're overhead from the side, we are never going to know which camp they're at. Jack, do you have any idea how big a deal it is to retask those satellites?
Yeah.
Eyebrows arched in alarm, Marty glances around the group. Later, in a satellite observation room, Jack studies negatives of a new set of aerial photos, while a technician sits at a computer and a large monitor.
Bring up Camp 18 again.
A photo image appears on the monitor. From high above, the tents are small patches in the sand.
Tighten on the camp here.
The technician encloses one part of the camp in a box, then enlarges it.
Let's look up in here. See what we can see.
Drawing the boxes with a computer, the technician encloses an area between the tents, then magnifies it. Figures appear, as small as insects.
Show me this group in here.
He enlarges 2 people who cast long shadows on the sand. At extreme magnification, the image is grainy and indistinct. Jack studies the screen and frowns.
No, that's nothing. Go back to the bigger picture. Let me see down here.
He enlarges a corner of the camp, revealing a figure sitting in front of a tent.
What's that? Tighten up on that, will you?
The technician isolates the figure in the computer's glowing blue box and magnifies it. The person's face is shielded by a cap.
Can you enhance that, sharpen it up?
He moves in even closer. Jack's mouth drops open as the fuzzy image comes into focus. It's a woman wearing a sleeveless tank top. Jack grins.
Tits.
Later, Admiral Greer peers through a microscope. He flips back and forth between photos of Kevin and Annette, her face partially hidden, and the woman in the desert. Jack rubs his eyes wearily. Greer shakes his head. He motions for Marty to take a look.
SAS could take out any one of these camps in under 2 minutes, kill everybody there, and be gone before the echo fades. Are you sure this is the same woman?
Jack lowers his eyes uneasily. He shoots Greer a weak, apologetic grin.
Keep at it, then.
Greer thumps him on the shoulder and walks out with Marty. Later, at the hospital, Jack slumps in a chair at Sally's bedside, sound asleep. A nurse tiptoes in, puts her fingers on Sally's wrist, and checks her pulse. Sally's eyes blink open. Jack stirs in his sleep and sees her through drooping lids. She grins lovingly.
Read it again, Daddy.
Jack blinks slowly and tries to rub the sleep from his eyes. He picks up a book and flips to the first page, then takes Sally's hand in his.
The sun did not shine. It was too wet to play. So we sat in the house all that cold, cold, wet day.
Sally's eyes drift shut. Jack gazes at her still face, then drops a tender kiss on her forehead.
I sat there with Sally. We sat there, we two. And I said how I wish we had something to do. Too wet to go out and too cold to play ball. So we sat in the house. We did nothing at all. So all we could do was to sit, 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 sit. And we did not like it. Not one little bit.
Later, in the hospital cafeteria.
And then something went.
Jack slumps at a table with a cup of coffee, then glances up in alarm. Patty O'Neill stands in front of him, carrying a box wrapped in teddy bear patterned paper. With a faint, challenging grin, he shoves the package at Jack and walks out. Jack gulps and stares at the present. He scans the now empty cafeteria, then cautiously lifts off the lid. Inside, a leprechaun doll rests on top of a manila envelope. The doll's box reads, Gifts from Ireland. Daytime. Jack drops the envelope and a stack of photos on Marty's desk.
Patty O'Neill can sleep at night. In fact, he probably enjoys the irony. She's not Irish. She's English.
Marty frowns at the pictures of Annette in various disguises.
And this is the girl you saw. In the blink of an eye, in a Jeep, as it passed you doing 40...
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do here?
Tell SO-13 you know who she is. Tell him her name. Give him her picture. Tell him that she poses as a rare book dealer and ask him to look for her. What do you mean, what do you do?
What am I supposed to do with you, Jack? You walk into a bar, half of whose customers want you dead. You walk up to the IRA's bag man, and in front of his guys, you threaten him?
You're not a field man, Jack. You never were. You are an analyst. Analyze that. I am not after your job, Marty. I'm after the man who tried to kill my family.
Then what do you think? You tell O'Neill that you're looking for a girl. He gives you the pictures of a girl. He obliges you to get you off his back, and you believe him?
I didn't tell him I was looking for a girl, Marty.
Marty's eyes fly open. He jerks his attention back to the photo in his hand. Annette's long-wigged face is circled. Now, in Cooley's rare bookshop, the portly, balding Cooley looks up from a desk covered with tattered, leather-bound volumes. He wrinkles his nose. He glances around the store, then looks up. Smoke seeps out of a light fixture in the ceiling. Panicking, Cooley throws off the light switch, then runs for a fire extinguisher.
Sarge, come and look at this.
In a storeroom, Owens heaves himself off a cot and joins two undercover officers in front of a surveillance monitor. On screen, we look down through the light fixture at Cooley. Later, an electrician inspects the wiring.
Bit of a bookworm myself. Not that you'd know it to look at me.
What's your passion, then? Mysteries? Spy novels? Familiar with Ian Fleming, are you?
This is a rare bookshop.
Rare books? Yeah, so they are.
Can you locate the problem, or do I have to call someone else?
I already have. The wiring in this old place dates from before the war. The First War. It's what we call in the electrical business, rare.
Yes, can you fix it?
Sure, fix it. Can you afford it? That's the question.
Just fix it.
Cooley settles back at his desk as the gaunt-faced electrician climbs onto a ladder and unscrews the ceiling fixture.
Hello.
You've seen it, haven't you?
I don't know.
The image on the monitor jiggles.
He's got it, look.
Yeah, what do you make of this?
He pulls out a miniature camera by its cable and points it at Cooley.
I have no idea.
Damn!
Cooley jumps up and pulls on his coat.
I have to go out now for a few minutes to deliver some books. Please keep about your repairs.
Oh, I'll be here all week, Gov, don't worry.
Clutching a white fedora, Cooley gazes helplessly around his store. He grabs a few books off his desk and dashes out. Shooting a frantic look up and down the sidewalk, he puts on his hat and runs. Owens and one of his men bolt out of a jewelry store and sprint after him. Now in a subway station. Clinging desperately to his books, Cooley shoves through a turnstile and scampers down several flights of stairs. Owens and the other officer race after him, elbowing commuters out of the way. They shove their way onto the subway platform, bustling with passengers. They look in both directions, then run from car to car, peering through the windows. From Owens's point of view, people shove past in a confused, jostling blur. Gritting his teeth, Owens gives up on the subway cars and scans the crowd. He sees something and freezes, then starts to run. Several yards in front of him, a white hat bobs among a group of schoolgirls. A schoolgirl wearing Cooley's hat gapes at Owens in surprise. A few feet away, Cooley heaves a deep sigh of relief. The subway doors close behind him, and the train starts to move. Now in Lord Holmes's office.
Dinner at the White House is no problem.
What is the problem?
No problem. We're just running out of dates.
Yes, we could do that. Move that there. I should leave us...
The 14th?
14th. Geoffrey, let's check with John Rann about scheduling a presentation dinner at our embassy in Washington on the,
14th.
The 14th.
Watkins smiles and walks away.
So let's go over this again so I can get it clear. We start in Washington with the White House...
He frowns and hurries to his desk.
Geoffrey Watkins?
Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm trying to reach Mr. Titus.
Is that extension 2691?
No, this is 2619.
I'm terribly sorry.
On a foggy pier, Cooley hangs up. In Holmes's office, Watkins frowns and opens a file. At the Ryans.
What are you doing up? Go back to bed.
I wanted to be there when she wakes up. I'll go with you and then I'll take a cab back.
Okay.
Hello? Yes, just a minute. It's for you, Sir John.
Hello.
Now, Watkins approaches Lord Holmes.
Excuse me, sir. Mr. Ryan has a special celebration that evening that he can't change. He wondered if you might care to join them. Where? At his house? Yes, sir.
His aides nod their approval.
Why not?
Watkins smiles politely. Now, in the desert, Kevin, Annette, and several of their men sit in a tent studying footage of Lord Holmes at an airport.
We shot this 8 days ago in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
One, two, three, four Brits traveling with him. light arms.
The heavy stuff's in the cars.
He's German. He's German.
This boring you, Sean?
Sean sits behind them, sulking.
Should be the same security when Holmes flies to Washington.
You've got to find the moment when he's unprotected.
4 days Washington. 1 day New York. Shopping.
Annette looks up from her computer printout with a tight, satisfied smile. Now at CIA. Jack squints through a microscope at an aerial photo of soldiers in the camp.
Two Caucasians. Take a look at the one with the hat.
A technician peers through the eyepiece.
His arms look a little pink.
Sunburn. New arrival.
Jack picks up another photo and slides it under the microscope. Our view glides across the parched, white beige sand to a portly, balding man sitting in front of a tent. Jack leans back in his chair.
What do you think, same guy?
Later, Jack shows the photos on a projection screen.
That rare book dealer, Dennis Cooley. He's bald. It's possible there could be a woman in some of these camps. But with her and Cooley in the same place, if that is Cooley, the odds of coincidence are dropping fast. Still, I don't know. There's no way I can be absolutely certain.
Excuse me, Jack. Tell me one thing in life that is absolutely for certain.
My daughter's love.
What I need to hear from you is your best guess, and I think I've heard it.
His back turned to Greer, Jack swallows hard.
Haven't I?
Jack's shoulders rise and fall in a sigh. He nods reluctantly. Now, Cooley trots behind Kevin and Sean.
The bastards took away my bookshop. They took away my books.
I'm sorry, Dennis, you can't come. You haven't got the training. And this mission's going to be very messy.
I can fire a gun.
Sean gives him a contemptuous smirk. Kevin tosses Cooley his assault rifle. Cooley fumbles it, then braces the butt against his shoulder and peers through the sight. He tries to fire, then lowers it in confusion. Sean yanks the gun out of his hands. Cooley jumps as Sean fires into the ground at his feet.
Sorry, Dennis.
Kevin nods to Sean, who points the gun at Cooley's head. Cooley's eyes fly open in surprise. Sean lowers the smoking gun and walks away. Nighttime. The camp is still. A single guard patrols outside the tents. At CIA, Jack and Marty ride an elevator. They walk to a closed door with a sign that reads, Exclusion Area.
Where are you taking me, Marty?
It's you who've taken us, Jack.
They step in.
Satellite now entering target area.
Into battle.
Greer and a half dozen analysts stand with their eyes glued to 5-foot monitors on the wall. Infrared images of helicopters, ghostly silhouettes against a bright blue background, fly across the screen.
Airborne support approaching target area. ETA, 35 seconds.
Jack glances at Greer, who stands with his arms crossed, scowling grimly. In the desert, two snub-nosed assault helicopters fly low over the sand, like giant black insects hovering in the night sky. They rise over a dune and fly toward us. When they pass overhead, their lights blink off. At the camp, the tents are dark. Two guards loiter outside. Now in the viewing room. Jack's eyes shift uneasily as he watches. On the infrared monitors, 8 soldiers appear as moving white dots running across the sand. In the desert, they materialize on the horizon like silent black shadows.
Enlarge Camp 18.
Enlarging.
Enlarge primary target.
Enlarging.
In eerie, fluorescent white silhouette, we watch from above as one soldier ambushes a guard who crumples.
That is a kill.
Jack glares at a young, smoothly groomed analyst who nonchalantly sips his coffee. On screen, the soldiers invade a tent, guns drawn. The figures inside jerk convulsively in their beds.
Targets have been neutralized.
The helicopters return and drop bombs from above. The soldiers swarm the camp.
Airborne support approaching.
Lifeless bodies sprawl on the ground where they fell. A rocket streaks across the monitor and blows up a tent. The fiery, brilliant white explosion obscures the scene below. A technician types command codes into her computer. The screen reads, "Live feed," in blinking green letters. Another tent explodes. The soldiers back away from the camp, sweeping their guns from side to side. Jack gulps as a man writhes on the ground, trying to crawl to safety. The computer reads, "Status, live."
Keyhole is passing out a visual.
The camp scene dissolves into static. Jack stares at the screen, lips trembling. He bows his head, then turns to a somber-faced Greer.
It's over.
Greer stares keenly at Jack, whose eyes are wide and haunted. Then he bows his head and walks away. Jack blinks hard and takes a deep, trembling breath. Daytime, at the Ryans. The sky overhead is filled with ominous gray clouds. The family station wagon pulls to a stop in front of the house. Jack climbs out and opens a back door. He lifts Sally out of the car. Smiling happily, she wraps her arms around his neck and snuggles her face against his shoulder. A banner over the porch, framed by balloons, reads, "Welcome home, Sally." Nighttime. Bolts of lightning zigzag through the blue-black sky. Agents with walkie-talkies surround the house. Another agent paces in the kitchen. Kathy walks past, carrying a cake.
Roger that.
You sure your men outside would like some coffee?
No, thank you, Miss Ryan. That'll be just fine.
Okay.
In the dining room, Lord Holmes, Watkins, Robbie, and his wife Sissy sit with the Ryans.
Beautiful and gracious young lady, and it's my distinct pleasure to make your acquaintance.
You're welcome.
I thought I might make the presentation after dinner, if you agree.
Sure.
Well, I think
Would you like to see it now, Jeffrey?
Watkins opens a wooden case, revealing a gold medal on a silk ribbon.
Didn't I already give you one of those?
Amid flashes of blue lightning, we look through the outside window into the cozy dining room. Everyone passes platters of food around the table, festively decorated with candles and flowers. Later, as the agents patrol the outside of the house, the guests have coffee and cake in the living room.
Where's the bathroom, Jack?
Second door on the left. More coffee, anyone?
I'd love some.
Excuse me.
Ooh, here it comes.
Bathroom?
The agent nods.
Someone in there.
No, it's not it. That's the basement.
He waves Watkins away from the basement door and opens it cautiously. Watkins aims a pistol at the back of his head in Jack's study.
Hello.
Jack? Marty.
Hey, Marty. What's going on?
I'm sorry to interrupt your party, but I thought you'd like to know right away. SAS just made positive ID on Dennis Cooley.
What about the others?
Well, it was pretty messy, as it turns out. It's going to take 48 hours to verify the dental records. But they're keeping right on it.
All the lights go out.
Oh, great.
What?
Storm just knocked out the power here to the house. I got to light some candles.
I'll light one for you, too.
Okay, Marty. Thanks.
Kathy lights candles in the living room.
What, forget to pay your bill, Kat?
Robert, very funny.
Is everyone all right?
We're fine, Jack.
Carrying a candle, Jack walks to the window and peers outside. Across the yard, lights glow from inside a boathouse. Jack's face grows hard and tense. Robbie wanders over.
Something wrong?
Come with me, Wayne.
They hurry out of the room.
If the storm had knocked out the lights, they'd be out the boathouse, too.
So?
Power comes in from the street and then branches off to here.
The kitchen is empty.
Jesus.
He grabs an unattended walkie-talkie.
This is Ryan. Any DSS agent?
Any DSS agent, this is Ryan.
Maryland troopers. Anyone?
Outside, flashes of blue lightning reveal an agent with a bullet hole in his head and another with his throat slit. Inside, Kathy carries Sally upstairs. Jack stalks across the room and picks up the phone.
Don't tell.
Quite a storm.
Jeffrey saunters in from the basement. Jack grabs his lapels.
Take your hands off me! What the hell do you think you're doing?
Jack!
He hurls him against the wall and throws him down the basement stairs.
Gun.
He hands Watkins' gun to Robbie.
Jack!
A trail of blood runs under another door into a boiler room. Jack flings Watkins through the door, then sees the dead agent. Watkins tries to get up.
Stay right there.
Rob, over here.
The switch on a circuit breaker is in the off position. Jack grabs Watkins.
What's the plan? I'm in here coming.
Where's Sean Miller?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Give me the gun.
He aims at his knee.
5, 6. I don't know, maybe more.
I'll get the others. Don't turn on the lights.
Outside, several shadowy figures run toward the house. Jack hurries into the living room and hands the pistol to Lord Holmes.
Take this, get down the basement quick.
Where's Kathy and Sally?
Here upstairs. Sally to bed.
Go.
What's wrong?
Jack runs into his study and turns on his security system. Its wall panel reads, silent alarm. A terrorist breaks the front door's glass with a gun. Jack peers around a corner. Sean and Kevin creep into the foyer, wearing night vision goggles with 6-inch scopes strapped to their foreheads. We scan the rooms through their goggles. Everything in the darkened house stands out clearly, filtered through incandescent green light.
Come on, Ryan. Show yourself.
They pace through the rooms, machine guns ready.
Nanette, upstairs.
Right.
Nanette brushes past him. Jack hides behind a bookshelf around the corner and watches her run up. He starts to follow, then ducks back as another assassin walks in. Upstairs, Kathy looks out the window and sees one of Kevin's men run across the lawn.
Come on, sweetie, come on. What's wrong, Mommy?
She hustles Sally into Jack's closet.
You gotta help me. Climb up on the stool. Shut it up there.
Crouched along a wall, Annette peers upstairs. Kathy reaches up and pulls a shotgun off of the shelf. Downstairs, Jack watches a terrorist stalk through the living room. Kathy rummages through a drawer.
Oh, God, Jack. What did you do with the shelves?
Annette reaches the second floor. Kathy turns off her flashlight.
Go, 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 go.
She and Sally duck down just as Annette's shadowy silhouette appears on the landing a few yards away. Through her goggles, we scan an empty bedroom. Downstairs, as one gunman skulks past him, Jack slips out from his hiding place. He jumps behind a cabinet as another assassin crosses the room. Upstairs, Annette prowls the hallway and creeps into Sally's pitch-black bedroom, cast in a glowing green light through her goggles. She darts in, sweeps her gun around the room, then steps into a bathroom. A door to Jack and Kathy's bedroom stands open on the other side. Jack races upstairs. Kathy moves Sally into the back of a walk-in closet and pushes her behind some hanging clothes. Annette wanders into the master bedroom. Through her goggles, our view focuses on a closed door. In the closet, Kathy opens the chamber of the shotgun and peers down its empty barrel. She chokes back a sob. Annette pauses, then opens the door and scans Jack and Kathy's dressing room. Kathy aims at the door. Through Annette's goggles, for a split second, we glimpse the butt end of the gun racing toward us. A Annette crumples. Sally grins.
All right. Sally. Sally. It's okay, honey.
Jack grabs Annette's machine gun, then looks up at the ceiling. In the basement, Lord Holmes helps Robbie drag Watkins behind a furnace. Sissy ducks behind the metal boiler. Robbie crouches low and aims his pistol at the closed boiler room door. A terrorist pauses just outside. Upstairs, Jack stands on a chair and pushes open a ceiling panel. He lifts Sally up and boosts her into the attic.
Just gotta be real quiet.
Downstairs, Robbie keeps his eyes glued to the door. Lord Holmes slaps his hand over Watkins' mouth. The gunman edges closer to the basement door. Upstairs, Kathy climbs into the attic and drops her flashlight.
Gotcha!
Sean looks up, then bolts up the stairs. In the basement, Robbie frowns anxiously. Now Sean cranes his neck and aims his gun at the ceiling. In the attic, Jack jumps as the bullets rip through the floor. Sean careens into a bedroom and spins wildly, knocking into the furniture. Spotlighted by flashes of blue lightning, Jack climbs out a window onto the roof. Sean looks down and sees Annette.
Christ.
Kathy steps onto the roof and lifts Sally in her arms. Clinging to the chimney below, Jack reaches up for her. She slips and rolls down the roof. Jack catches her. Now Sean climbs into the attic and appears at the window just as the Ryans reach the ground. He cringes as a flash of lightning blinds him. Now at CIA.
What are you talking about? Who is off the air?
DSS, state troopers, everyone. The security company...
Get me hostage rescue at Quantico now.
Carrying Sally, Kathy runs with Jack to the basement's outer door.
Robbie! Open up! Robbie, it's us!
Jack!
Inside, Sean drops down from the attic.
They're outside!
Sean, cool it. It's the royal we want. We can't ransom a dead body.
Jack and his family hide in the basement.
They're all over the place, man.
Stay close, sweetie.
Jack points the machine gun at Watkins.
How are you gonna get away, huh? You wanna go for the other knee? Come on!
Holmes ungags him.
Boats. Bottom of the cliff. Several ropes.
Kevin!
Lord Holmes clubs Watkins in the face. In the hall, two of Kevin's men step cautiously into the basement and pause outside the closed boiler room door. Inside, everyone crouches in the shadows. The gunmen push open the door and scan the room. Suddenly, Jack flips on the circuit breaker. The men's goggles are filled with excruciating white light. Robbie shoots both men in the chest. Upstairs, Sean whips his head toward the sound and bolts down the hallway. He leads Annette and Kevin into the basement. They crouch around the corner from the boiler room. Sean aims at the open door. Jack leads everyone outside. Sean leans into the boiler room. Watkins sits up. Sean sprays bullets everywhere, hitting Watkins in the chest. Then he desperately searches the room. Outside, everyone bolts across the lawn and disappears in the trees. Annette and Kevin kneel beside Watkins.
You killed him!
Sean flings himself at the door to the outside. A spade is pushed through the door's handles, locking it. Now at Quantico, a helicopter lifts off the landing pad. At the Ryans, bullets shatter the spade handle. Sean bursts through the door and scans the deserted lawn. Carrying a flashlight, he leads Annette and Kevin to the front of the house. They pause to survey the grounds, their tight black wetsuits almost disappearing in the shadows. Sean takes off toward the cliff. Kevin searches the bushes around the house. Annette charges onto the porch and peers through the windows. Pelted by driving rain, Sean peers over the cliff. Below, one of two covered speedboats starts its engine. Sean raises his machine gun.
No, Sean, no! We need Holmes alive! We're past that! Alive!
Sean glares furiously at Kevin, then runs to the edge of the cliff and grabs a dangling rope. Below, the boat starts to pull away from shore.
Come on!
Kevin and Annette grab more ropes and start to rappel down the side of the cliff, pushing off from the rocks with their feet as they slide down to the rocky beach. The boat churns away. Now the rescue helicopter flies over the ocean, beaming a spotlight over the choppy waves. Dressed in FBI uniforms, the agents in the cockpit search the water.
Any contact?
Still off the air.
Now, Sean swims out to the remaining speedboat, which pitches wildly in the storm. He hauls himself in ahead of Kevin and Annette, who lag behind, struggling against the waves. They climb in just as Kevin starts the engine. The other boat, its deck hidden behind its canvas canopy, is less than 100 yards away.
There he is!
Kevin beams a powerful spotlight at the fleeing boat as Sean steers into the wind. On the rocky shore, everyone but Jack huddles behind boulders.
Stay down.
Sean's boat skims over the churning surf as they chase Jack. On shore, Kathy hugs Sally tightly, tears running down her rain-soaked cheeks. Now Jack looks over his shoulder as Sean's boat closes the distance between them. Rain and salt spray stream off his face. Our view tosses and turns with the boat as it bounces off the rough surf.
You bastards!
Wind rips the canopy from over Jack's head.
Come on! Come on!
He's alone! He's leading us away from the Royal! Turn around, Sean!
No!
Turn it round, Sean! Turn it round,
no.
Sean!
Kevin struggles to grab the wheel.
Turn it round! Turn it round!
Forget about Ryan!
Don't blow the mission now, boy!
That's not my mission!
Sean blasts Kevin with his machine gun. Annette aims her pistol at him.
You crazy bastard!
Annette's body flies backward as Sean riddles her with bullets. He props his machine gun on the railing and aims at Jack's boat. Jack ducks. Our view rolls wildly. Sean's boat, caught in a strobe of brilliant blue lightning, skips violently over the waves. Sparks fly as bullets hit Jack's gas tank. A sheet of fire races across the stern. The flames leap fiercely into the wind. Jack watches Sean's boat bounce closer. He ties a rope to the steering wheel and turns around. Sean's spotlight cuts through the rain like a glowing white eye. Sean pauses to reload. Jack lunges for a fire extinguisher. Now Sean's boat races neck and neck with Jack's. Jack crouches behind the cockpit and sprays at the fire. Sean runs out of ammunition and slams his gun. Clutching a knife, he climbs onto the side of his boat, crouches, and jumps onto Jack's boat. Jack hurls himself on top of Sean and pins him down. The fire rages out of control as Jack and Sean wrestle in the bow. Sean picks up a long metal gaff and clubs him across the neck. Jack sprawls on his back, then rolls onto his knees and tries to drag it out of his hands. Sean presses him onto his back and shoves the gaff against his throat. Jack forces it away. He bashes Sean with the gaff. Sean collapses, then picks up a 3-foot-long metal anchor with pointed, razor-sharp arms. He swings and misses. The anchor embeds in the boat, arms pointing in the air. Sean dives on top of Jack and grapples for the gaff. He slams it against Jack's neck, forcing his head toward the fire. The boat careens out of control over the crashing waves. Jack struggles, then pounds Sean in the face with one end of the gaff. The terrorist falls back, impaling himself on the anchor. Blinking in shock, Sean opens his blood-filled mouth. Then his head drops. Gasping, Jack bows his head, then looks up. The boat races toward a jagged rock shelf jutting out of the water. He scrambles to his feet and dives off the speeding boat. The boat explodes into a 50-foot mushroom of fire. The FBI helicopter pilots jerk their attention toward the flames. Buffeted by the waves, Jack bobs up and down in the water. The helicopter captures him in its spotlight, a tiny figure surrounded by flaming wreckage. Jack gasps with an elated smile, his eyes squeezed shut against the rain as he struggles to stay afloat. Later, dozens of detectives and police officers comb through the Ryan's house, snapping pictures and dusting for fingerprints. Jack huddles on the couch, his arms wrapped tightly around Kathy and Sally, a blanket bundled around all three of them. Sally's eyes are closed in exhausted sleep. Kathy leans her head on his shoulder, her face blank with shock. Blinking back tears, Jack pulls them closer and kisses their wet hair. The scene dissolves to a new day. Sally does homework at the kitchen table, while Kathy packs her lunchbox and Jack fixes breakfast.
Got enough to eat, honey, or do you want something? You want some toast or
pancakes?
No time for pancakes, honey. You want toast or toast?
Toast. Is somebody gonna get that?
Getting it.
Sally.
Hello.
Kiddos.
It is. Yeah, hold on a second.
Where's your backpack?
It's Dr. Zalian.
Damn you.
Yeah.
Hello. Is it going to be okay?
It's going to be fine, honey. We're just waiting to find out.
Kathy grins with relief.
Great.
What do you want on your toast, honey? Strawberry?
A list of baby names hangs on the refrigerator door.
You want to know what it is?
Did he tell you?
He's asking. I'm asking you.
No, I don't know. Do you want to know?
I don't know. Do you?
Well, I thought I wanted to know, but now I'm not so sure.
Hold on a second, we're discussing it.
Me neither. I mean, I do and I don't.
Jack stares helplessly at Kathy.
He's waiting.
Sally shrugs, then nods. Jack grins.
Okay. Tell us.
Okay, tell us.
Sally bites her lip. Jack's mouth hangs open in anticipation.
Thank you.
Kathy smiles. Jack's eyebrows shoot up. The scene cuts to black. This film has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, a service of the WGBH Educational Foundation. Funding provided by the United States Department of Education. Described by Leslie Wu Foley. Descriptions read by Nick Mills. Credits roll. Cast: Harrison Ford as Jack Ryan, Ann Archer as Kathy Ryan, Patrick Bergen as Kevin O'Donnell, Sean Bean as Sean Miller, Thora Birch as Sally Ryan, James Fox as Lord Holmes, Samuel L. Jackson as Robbie, Polly Walker as Annette, J.E. Freeman as Marty Cantor, James Earl Jones as Admiral Greer, Richard Harris as Patty O'Neill, Alex Norton as Dennis Cooley, Hugh Fraser as Watkins, David Threlfall as Inspector Highland, Alan Armstrong as Owens, Berlinda Tolbert as Sissy, Hugh Ross as Barrister Atkinson, Gerald Sim as the Lord Justice, Pip Torrens as the First Aide, Thomas Russell as Ashley, Jonathan Ryan as Jimmy O'Riordan, Andrew Connolly as Charlie Dugan, Carl Hayden as Paddy Boy, Claire Oberman as Lady Holmes, Oliver Stone as Young Holmes, Tom Watt as the Electrician, P.H. Moriarty as the Court Guard, Rebecca Mayhook as the Schoolgirl, Roger Blake, Martin Cochran, and Tim Dutton as the Constables, Ellen Gere as Rose, John Lafayette as Winter, Duke Musikian as Pharaoh, Fritz Sperberg as Spiva, Brenda Clemmie as the Secretary, Allison Barron as the CIA Analyst, Theodore Ramey as the CIA Technician, Philip Levian as Dr. Shapiro, Jesse Goines as FBI Agent Shaw, John Shepard as the FBI Helicopter Pilot, Stephen Held as the FBI Rifleman, Deborah Weston as the CNN Reporter, Bob Gunton as the Interviewer, Ivan Kane and Kim Delgado as the TV reporters, K. Keith Campbell as Ned Clark, Jeff Mandan and Eric Paul as the Marine Guards, Jeff Gardner, Lester T. Tillery, Franklin Dam, Frankie Maldonati, Bonnie Webster, Pamela Saxon, and Leah Tabassi as the midshipman, Michael Ryan Way as Avery, Gregory Paul Jackson as the taxi driver, Fred Toma as the Arab soldier, Ruben Garfias as the anesthesiologist, Michael Francis Kelly as O'Neill's bodyguard, stunt coordinators David R. Ellis and Steve Boyum, stunts Greg Barnett, Bobby Bass, Janet Brady, Michael Brady, David Burton, William H. Burton, Clark Coleman, Cynthia Seipert, Jeff Dashnaugh, Steve Davison, Tim A. Davison, Annie Ellis, Chinoa Ellis, Richard Ellis, Kenny Endoso, Tony Epper, Jim Halty, Scott W. Hubble, Jeff Imada, Henry Kingy, Joel Kramer, Terry J. Leonard, John Meyer, Gary McClarty, Benny Moore, Alan Olney, Chuck Piscerny Jr., Steve Piscerny, Chad Randall, and Dick Zeiker. UK stunts, stunt coordinator Martin Grace. Stunts, Andy Bradford, Jerry Crampton, Gabe Cronally, Elaine Ford, Paul Jennings, Phil Lonergan, Mark McBride, Valentino Musetti, Tony Van Silva, and Rod Woodruff. Helicopter pilots, Craig Hosking, Harold D. House, Cliff Fleming, and Chris B. Saunders. Casting, UK and Ireland, John and Roz Hubbard. Unit production manager, William C. Garrity. First assistant director, Dennis McGuire. Second assistant director, Matthew J. Dunn. Associate producer, Liz Kern. Art director, Joseph P. Lucky. Set decorator, John M. Dwyer. Camera operators, Mark O'Kane and Mike St. Hilaire. First assistant photographer, Mark Davison. Second assistant photographers, Cynthia Pushek and Dwayne Manwiller. Still photographer, Merrick Morton. Video assist operator, Phil Silver. Production sound mixer, Jack Solomon. Boom operator, Dennis Jones. Utility sound, James E. Thompson. Script supervisor, Karen Wookie. Chief lighting technician, Stephen R. Mathis. Assistant chief lighting technicians, Brett Lauman and Ed Cooper. Electricians, Ted Miller, Liz Rosenblatt, Dave Tutake, Brian Crane, and John Byers. First company grip, Steve Smith. Second company grips, Bruce Byall and Edward A. Jackson. Dolly grip, John W. Murphy. Grips, Dave Vanderberg, Tim Collins, Todd Griffith, Doug Boone, and Newton Lucas. Set designer, Walter P. Martitius. Illustrator, David J. Negron, Jr. Art department coordinator, Carla Sue Nemec. Makeup artists, Peter Rob King and Patricia A. Gerhardt. Hairstylist, Linda Gurisich. Ms. Archer's hairstylist, Anne Michelle Morgan. Assistant costume designer, Kimberly J. Adams. Costume supervisors, Christine Hines and Michael W. Hoffman. Costumers, Charles R. DeMuth, Leslie Joyce, and Ronald V. Barry. Property master, Eric L. Nelson. Assistant property masters, David P. Newell and David Aaron. Lead person, Barton M. Sussman. Special effects coordinator, Dale L. Martin. Special effects crew, Joe Quinlivan, Terry King, Robert Worthington, Frank Foster, Jim Rollins, and Leo Solis. Mr. Noyce's associate, Laura Wiederman. Unit publicist, Jane E. Russell. Second unit director, David R. Ellis. Second unit director of photography, Michael A. Benson. First assistant director, Christopher T. Garrity. Second assistant director, James W. Greenhut. First assistant photographer, Tony Rivetti. Second assistant photographer, Kelly Green. Script supervisor, Andrea Walzer. Chief lighting technician, Ramon Rao. First company grip, David Fay. Additional editing, Lisa M. Citron. First assistant editor, Tim Tomasino. Assistant editors, Craig Galloway and Judd Meslansky. Assistant editor, London, Andrew McRitchie. Supervising sound editors, George Waters II and Cecilia Hall. Sound effects editors, F. Hudson Miller, R.J. Palmer, Frank Howard, Howell Gibbons, Larry Mann, Suhail Cafferty, and Noah Blau. Supervising ADR editor, Juno J. Ellis. ADR editor, Denise Horta. Supervising Foley editor, Victoria Martin. Foley editors, Matt Harrison and Les Wolf. Assistant sound editors, Marva Fucci, Maggie Ostroff, and Craig Sims. Additional sound effects by John Paul Fasal. ADR mixer, Bob Barron. Foley mixer, Greg Curda. Foley artists, Ken Dufa and David Lee Fine. Re-recording mixers, Andy Nelson, Steve Peterson, and Tom Perry. Music editor, Jim Henriksen. Orchestrator, John Neufeld. Additional orchestrations by Conrad Pope. Orchestra contractor, Nathan Kaproff. Music preparation, Bob Bornstein. Music scoring mixer, Sean Murphy. Voice casting, Barbara Harris. Production auditor, Louis B. Phillips. Assistant production accountant, Tony Criscione. Post-production accountant, Joan Flannery. Location manager, Stuart A. Newman. Assistant location manager, Peter Julian Novak. Locations assistant, Charlie Armstrong. Second Assistant Director John G. Scotti, DGA Trainee Leslie D. Franks, Production Office Coordinator Debbie Schwab, Assistant Production Office Coordinator Amy Jill Wallace, Navy Technical Advisors Captain Michael T. Sherman, USN, and Lieutenant James E. Brooks, USN, Government Relations John Horton, Assistant to Mr. Neufeld Kathy Day, Assistant to Mr. Ramey Joanne Satrino, Assistant to Mr. Ford Leslie Adler, Casting Associate Julie Hutchinson. Production Assistants, Robert Newland Maseraki, Joseph E. Lotito, Aaron M. Albucker, Scott W. Anderson, Sean McCarran, Patricia B. Klug, Eduardo Andrade, and Gary Robinson. Transportation Coordinator, Jim Thornsberry. Transportation Captains, Tony Steer and Richard D. Johnson. Construction Coordinator, Robert Kroom. Construction Forepersons, Ed Vance, Dean Hensley, and Wes Nordby. Construction Assistant, James Geis. Construction Accountant, Velma Geis. Paint Foreperson Gary A. Clark. Scenic Painter James H. Betts. Craft Service Vartan S. Chakirian and Robert Redwine. Catering by Michelson Food Service. UK Crew Production Manager Denise O'Dell. Art Director Alan Cassie. Set Dresser Stephanie McMillan. Assistant Directors Tim Lewis, Robert Fabry, and Richard Whalen. Assistant Directors Second Unit Ian Hickenbotham, Paul Taylor, and Justin Muller. Directors of Photography, Stephen Smith and James Devis. Camera Operator, Jeremy G. First Assistant Photographers, Simon Hume and Mark Moriarty. Still Photographer, Keith Hampshire. Sound Mixer, Ivan Sharrock, CAS. Boom Operator, Dave Mata. Video Coordinator, Chris Warren. Chief Lighting Technician, Chuck Finch. Assistant Art Director, Dennis Bosher. Storyboard Artist, Roger Deere. Makeup Artists, Jane Royal and Norma Webb. Hairstylists, Elaine Bauerbank and Betty Glasso. Costume Supervisor Rosemary Burrows. Costumers Colin Wilson and Janet Teabrook. Property Master Peter Hancock. Property Buyer Brian Reed. Production Accountant Terry Mellis. Location Managers Malcolm Christopher and Rachel Neal. Production Coordinator Janine Lodge. Police Liaison Wilf Knight. Production Office Assistants Lara O'Dell and Samantha Thomas. Construction Coordinator Terry Apsey. Construction Forepersons John New and John McGregor. Special Effects Supervisor George Gibbs. Special Effects Technicians Joss Williams, Clive Beard, Trevor Neighbor, and Andy Williams. Visual Effects and Video Displays by Video Image. Rhonda C. Gunner, Richard E. Hollander, Gregory L. McMurray, and John C. Wash. Video Image Crew. Glenn Neufeld, Janet Earl, Antoine Durr, Scott Geigler, Greg Kozakowski, Scott Peterson, Dean Stripicki, Monty Swan, and Larry Weiss. Video Image Process Coordinator, Robert Grassmere. Process Compositing by Hansard. Musco Lighting Technician, Kirk Hunsaker. Vescam Aerial Services provided by CRM Group Incorporated. Color Timer, Bob Putinkowski. Negative Cutting, Teresa Rapola Mohammed. Title Design, R.E.D. Productions. Titles and Opticals by Cinema Research Corporation. Music from Soundtrack, licensed through Milan America Incorporated. Available on RCA Records, CDs, and cassettes in the U.S. and Canada. JVC Victor Musical Industries Incorporated in Japan, Hong Kong, Korea, and Taiwan. Milan Records, CDs, and cassettes throughout the rest of the world. Music, Washington Post March by John Philip Sousa. Harry's Game by P. Brennan, performed by Clannad, courtesy of BMG Records, UK, Limited. The Pride of Our Land by Padraig and Noel Dugan, performed by Blended Spirits. Vocal accompanist to score, Maggie Boyle. Maggie Boyle performs courtesy of Run River Records. Trademark and copyright 1992 by Paramount Pictures Corporation. All rights reserved. Color by Technicolor. Filmed in Panavision, Dolby Stereo in selected theaters. Filmed on location at Pinewood Studios, Annapolis, Maryland, and California. The producers wish to thank the Department of Defense, the Department of the Navy, the United States Naval Academy, the Brigade of Midshipmen, the U.S. Department of the Interior Bureau of Land Management, and the California Film Commission. Pre-recorded videotape supplied by CNN Cable News Network, Incorporated. Computer equipment provided by Data General. Selected monitors provided by Proton and Ikigami Electronics, USA, Incorporated. The Cat in the Hat, written by Dr. Seuss, copyright 1985, used by permission. Denny and Wanda Pettyclair, The Richards Corporation. Shannon Distributors, Ireland, Limited. The Monahan Company, Scottsdale, Arizona. And Nigel Wool.